be a great tree that would shade the universe. So the beginning of the new opportunity for regeneration was the resurrection of the sun god at the vernal equinox. Now this was carried over into theology and brought into contact with many different legends and myths in all parts of the world. But in every one of these different systems, the actual sense of the matter was that the human being in his own growth passes from conception to birth, and in passing from conception to birth fulfills the first part of his journey. He then is born, and the birth, the physical birth, is the beginning of the journey through the chambers of initiation. It is at that point that the entity begins to unfold the potential. Here the small twig of Acacia is revealed. It is shown that the life is there, that in the winter it appeared to die, but it was not dead, it sleepeth, and it comes forth again. And in the life of every individual, when sorrow, misery, destruction, evil things plague the life, make it seem very difficult, by quiet contemplation of realities, we all discover that there is in us the germ of an immortality that cannot perish. But that when we really desire and start a conscious journey towards truth, at that moment, the little seed within ourselves begins to build the inner life for us. The seed becomes the tree of the soul, as it was called by Bhimi. So we can start out on all the problems and processes of life. And we are not shown what to do or told exactly. We have the experience of our ancestors. We have three great directives to help us. One of these directives is observation, to see what is happening in the world. Another directive is experimentation, to try a thing and see if it works. The third one is tradition, the gift we receive as a legacy from our ancestors, who have passed through all kinds of experiences and problems. If we are able to use these three instruments, they will guide us, or guide the sun, from the vernal equinox to the summer solstice. It will then bring into play all of the labors of life, for it is from the time of the planting to the time of the harvest that the individual must guard his properties, must sacrifice his time and energy to protect the crop which he hath planted. The farmer, therefore, is most busy in those months in which it is necessary for him to prepare for the harvest that is to come. Therefore, in life, young people must prepare for the harvest of the years. Those starting out must build for the future. And in each instance, the great supreme power to achieve that which is most necessary or most desired lies in the dedication of the individual to the principles of his religion. Actually, therefore, the ancients didn't have religions just the way we have them. They didn't have so much formalization. Most religions of antiquity were religions of joy. There were very few sorrows in the religions of ancient peoples, because they believed so firmly in the reality of good that they even accepted troubles and tragedies as testings of good, of means of strengthening. Adversity tempers the steel of the human soul, making it strong in emergencies. And the old peoples of the worlds of long ago accepted many of the problems that we reject simply because they realized they were part of life. So in this part of the testimony, we go back again to the temples, and we find that the disciples take these initiatory vows and begin the journey through the three primary degrees of initiation. And the sun does the same thing in the three primary degrees between the testing of the soul and the entry of the cycle, the sun cycle, into Capricorn. Here we find three definite efforts made to prepare the individual for the three great steps that he must take later. Here he is supposed to conquer the three parts of himself which are subject to the stress of initiation: the body, the heart, and the mind. But the body, he must discipline the flesh until it becomes serviceable as an instrument to give it all care that is necessary. No legitimate system of ancient religion ever tormented or tortured the body for purification. It was simplified. All the luxuries might be eliminated, but it was necessary to protect the body because it was the contact with the world of experience. And without that, the great trip could not be successfully made. After the body was obedient to the will and to the heart, then the second step was the purification of the emotions and the heart. Here the individual had to generate a new discipline upon the emotional life of himself. He must purify his affections. He must control his appetites. He must have all kinds of hope and a positive and constructive emotions. He must gradually overcome criticism. He must cure the causes of neuroses and things of this nature. So that actually, the second step in the three steps was to gain control of all pressures which arise through illusion and fantasy within the life of the person. Then the third step consisted of the purification of the mind. The mind so that it could be no longer a problem to the life of the person. The purification of thought included, of course, complete overcoming of selfishness, self-interest, pride, all of the arrogances and all of the worldly values which many people cling to so tenaciously. In other words, the mind must be detached from everything which will not survive after the body dies. We have to take with us in the mind only that which is not dependent upon the body, but is dependent upon the insight of the individual himself. Now, having accomplished these three labors over these three signs, the individual has become gradually cleared of some of the problems which we face today, because in these recent times we have lost contact almost entirely with this concept. We are no longer in a position to understand just what all this adds up to. But one thing we do know is that gradually so-called progress has destroyed the integrity of millions and millions of people. We are no longer able or willing to use the body and the physical embodiment for the improvement of nature, for the strengthening of character, for the extensions of knowledge, and through the birth and rebirth within ourselves of those elements and factors and parts which are necessary to our perfection. We have therefore gradually changed our Father's house into a place of merchandise. We have taken it and we have disfigured the entire purpose of evolution. We have failed to recognize the real reason for the gift of the sacred year. For a year is a period set aside for the growth of beings. It has something to do every year in repeating and repeating the evidence of what is necessary. The year becomes the great teacher of each person if that person will be observant of what happens during the months of that year. He will also gradually come to recognize that the loss of the memory of the past at cancer when he enters the gates of oblivion, this loss is restored to him at Capricorn. And as he brings his life into perfect order, the whole pattern of his life will be revealed again. He will remember, whereas previously he forgot. Previously he forgot his divinity and remembered only the humanity that was being born in him. At Capricorn, he is no longer locked into the memory of material things, but restores his memory of the divine world from which he came. So the year is a very great symbol of things, a symbol that we all could do something about. If, however, we imagine for a moment that this whole pattern of this astrotheology does have a meaning that is more profound than we realize, we know that it was protected in one way or another, so that the human being who was not prepared to receive it would not be likely to gain a knowledge which would damage him. But now everything has more or less changed. The old systems have gone away. There are still traces of them, and some very good older systems still function. But for the most part, people today have no consideration for the consequences of action, and they have no realization of indebtedness to the universe, a debt which must be paid by conduct. While this condition remains as it is, we have some of the great tragedies of life. At some time in the remote past, for example, science, which was in the hands of a very exclusive group, not exclusive in the sense of snobbish, but exclusive in the sense of knowing, informed, and morally incorruptible. This knowledge was placed in the keeping of persons who had already forsworn all personal advantage, had already forsworn any action for profit that was contrary to principle, and had accepted the obligation that everything that man discovers must be brought to the altar of God. Now, as a result of this type of disagreement, and discourtesy at the moment, we can take a little look at science. Here we have probably one of the most valuable instruments the world has ever been given, an instrument founded in the great triad of mathematics, astronomy, and music. Science, which has developed itself in many, many ways and has given us a great number of very pleasant privileges and has made life easier for millions of people, and in this respect has gained our confidence. But we begin to notice something. We notice that the scientist has not taken the obligations that were given in the ancient mysteries. He has not forsworn fame. He has not declared that he will invent only that which will serve good. He does not permit his secrets to be carried out if he is properly informed, if they will bring damage or injury to any other living thing. So what is happening? We have a scientific world which has given us much to be grateful for, but might sometime give us that which will extinguish all the good that science has ever given. This is the type of thing that was a great concern to the ancients, that they will prevent the abuse of the greater knowledge that gradually comes to the human being. This greater knowledge was therefore protected by the rites of initiation, the basic rites of 3 degrees, by means of which it was possible for the person, representing again the embodiment of the sun, to become morally responsible. So in the 1st degree of the ancient rites were given the first primary purifications. Purification in the mystery system was only symbolized by baptism, because the real purification was not given by water. It was given by the divine power of deity itself. But in this first step, the mind, the heart, and the body were cleansed of selfishness and self-interest. The individual became as a little child, seeking truth, realizing that the things around him which he has assumed to be truth are not necessarily true. Many things that we believe are not so. Many things that we disbelieve will ultimately be proven to be true. And in this mystery of uncertainties, it is very much to our advantage to place certain disciplines upon our own attitudes. We may not know yet why we should do it or how we should make these applications, but that something has to happen inside the individual before it is safe to bestow upon him the wisdom of his race is more or less obvious. There is a great body of wisdom, and there is a great race of people who have found it, built it, created systems for the perpetuation of it, but have never applied it to their own lives. They have never done those things in themselves which can make them safe custodians of the future. In the ancient mystery rites, the Pythagoreans, for example, the master told the disciples very definitely that every disciple who went forth to teach in his turn must do everything possible to find a successor. This successor must be a person whom he has instructed, or has found to be adequately instructed. And only to the person who already has earned the right can the master bestow the mantle of his leadership. And if by any chance he passes out of this life without finding a disciple that is worthy, that is itself part of the necessary lesson. Therefore, to pass on any knowledge in which there is a power to injure, until a person has proven that he is no longer capable of injuring, anything else is dangerous. And it was this kind of ethics of building knowledge into a qualified group that we have known in ancient rites. Now, some people hold these ancient rites to be snobbish, selfish, and that these leaders have intentionally concealed truth, because they wanted to govern other people or wanted to be masters over slaves. History has no strength for that support at all. There is no effort to recognize, or no opportunity to prove, or no way of proving that those who truly possess great knowledge were the ones who were the cause of trouble. The ones who are the cause of trouble are those who want to resist knowledge and gain authority by allowing people to be less than they should be. Therefore, that which wishes to be popular, first of all, makes a virtue out of things that are not true. And as a result of that, everyone is worse off. Now, in the initiation rites as they were given, the first degree is that of purification. The second degree is that of service. The first degree, the individual tries to clean the inside of his own cup. The second degree, he is dedicated to the service of some need or some person in his environment or for whom he has responsibility. A servant, in this sense of the word, may go out and become a leader of peoples in the right direction, may become a clergyman or a priest, or also an instructor, a teacher, a guide to other people. Or, in the same spirit and in the same light, he may serve only in his own house. He may serve his family. He may serve relatives who are ill. He will guard and protect his children. He will sacrifice his own profit and his own pleasure to the security of his family. He will be unselfish in his use of possessions, gentle and kindly and forbearing in his dealings with those around him. This is the simple sign. One individual may go out and rule a country. The other may stay home and rule himself and his family justly, lovingly, and wisely. Both are fulfilling the same requirement. Both are therefore servants of principles greater than those of ordinary commitments. After that comes the third step, in which the veil of the temple is opened to allow the professed person to begin to gain the full meaning of what he has gone through. In the third step, the individual receives that amount of instruction that is necessary for him at the moment given. He is then given the keys to use certain knowledge which was previously denied him. Now, in the idea that this knowledge comes simply from another person is not quite true either. The actual fact is that if the person is purified in his inner life, dedicated to the needs of others, the next thing that he needs will be revealed to him by his own conduct. He will discover that which he needs next because he needs it. But if he is not ready for it, he seeks for it in vain. And the idea that he can find something he doesn't deserve is not supported in the old systems. It is that he must deserve before the truth can be given to him. And if he gains what appears to be truth without deserving it, it will ultimately end in deceit and destruction. So those were the three steps that the average person has to follow, just as the sun has to follow. It goes from its birth to its point of greatest restoring and resurrecting power. It passes from there to the time when it goes to harvest, and then it goes into the silence of winter. Now, what is the silence of winter in relationship to this mystery cycle? Is it really an evil thing? Not according to the old rites, it isn't. Winter might be considered is the great Sabbath. It is the time of rest. It is the time in which all things which have passed through experience are rewarded by rest and repose. Winter is the time of peacefulness within. It is the time where the individual no longer has to labor, but has to rest for a time before he goes forth on another cycle. In other words, in the terms of the men and women of the desert, the winter is the caravansary, the place of rest and repose, where the individual who has completed the cycle of life has an opportunity to prepare for further life. Well, the ancients held that under that heading also came what was termed digestion. This is an alchemical term that is very interesting and has great significance for us. Digestion means that having passed through a series of experiences, it is necessary for the individual to summarize what he has accomplished. It is necessary to transform an experience into an awakening of inner value. The individual has had a life with many problems. He has had many different decisions to make. And in the Pythagorean discipline of retrospection, he goes back over the years of his life to find out what he has really learned, to know what mistakes he has made, and also how he corrected those that he discovered. He finds out how the weaknesses of his own character are still holding him back. He discovers where little germs of self-centeredness have prevented certain magnificent facts from being manifested fully to him. In retrospection, in the Pythagorean school, was usually given at night, or just before bed, asleep. And that in the great solar cycle, this retrospection is part of the cycle of winter. This cycle of winter is a very interesting phenomenon because we know very little about it, except everything seems to go to rest or go to sleep. And there are few things, however, like the evergreen, which was among ancient peoples always the symbol of immortality, and therefore the Christmas tree, that in this phase of the situation, the soul comes to a temporary condition of after-death awareness. It is not judged by something else, it is judged by itself. There is a recapitulation, as is also referred to in some cases, where it is said the persons in desperate condition in this world, in drowning or something of this nature, see their whole life go before them again in reverse order. This is to a great degree the same principle involved, except in the after-death state, there is no judgment, there is no punishment, except what the individual bestows upon himself in the reviewing of his own conduct. He is not whipped by some evil spirit. He is not damned by an avenging deity. He is simply detached from body to contemplate what he has learned while embodied, which will help him to be unembodied forever. This is the situation, more or less as it stands. The individual must finally become his own judge and jury. And this is possible because of the deity that abides within himself. He is judged by himself, but he is judged no longer with the modifications of his personal interests and desires. He is not judged because he wants to do this or wants to do that, and he cannot say, "I'm sorry, but that was the way it was then." He has to face the exact fulfillment of his previous life. He has to realize what he did was right and what was not right. And for those who have had a very miserable existence with very little discipline, the experience will probably be a little humbling. But never evil, never corrupt, never a terrible pain, but rather a deep realization of failure. But always in the realization of failure, the promise of ultimate fulfillment. So that in the dark part of the winter, we find the loneliness of that which is the human state. Every human being is in a sense alone and will always be lonely until it can be restored to the eternity which is its proper nature. So that in the winter, the individual becomes a little bit aware of the necessity of fulfilling his own winter. And lots of elderly people look back upon a very constructive and useful life. They're pretty well satisfied that they've done it as good as they could do it. And when they're unbodied, then they will also have a clearer vision of what it all meant. Very often the individual can only say, well, I did sacrifice myself because I felt it was necessary. But this isn't the real message. The real message is found only when the inner life itself, freed from body, estimates the values and merits of its own accomplishments. And very often these accomplishments are better than we think. And very often these accomplishments cause the simple person to be given precedence by his own conduct over those who seem to be much more advanced than himself. After this experience of winter comes again the problem of a new spring of life. And in this experience, the soul goes to sleep again. And after going through this particular experience, the soul begins to fade. It goes into a kind of a deep rest, a repose. And you'll find that in studying various books dealing with these subjects, there is really very seldom any description or any discussion of the interval between embodiments. We have long assumed, of course, that this interval was filled with compensations and punishments and so forth. But let's realize for once and for all that all of these things are internal. That the individual in the interval does have a communion with themselves. They are not surrounded by fork-tailed demons. They are not punished forever. They are not lost. They are not lost souls. They are people who are trying to explain to themselves the mistakes they made last time and making resolutions not to make them again. In other words, it is a quiet self-contemplation. Now, if a person has committed some very serious fault or some very evil deed, then in this clear atmosphere of realization, this sudden experience of a larger existence than the person ever realized in the material world, there can be some serious repentance. There can be a realization of the great mistake that was made, and also perhaps a dedication of some kind to remedy that mistake in any way possible. In other words, the individual is born into this life, again through the gate of cancer, not just simply as a brand new little infant, but as a person or a being that has learned something by an after-death cycle, and that this learning must be incorporated into the new embodiment. This learning must become part of what is brought forward into the new incarnation. And it is the nature of things that each incarnation should be a little improvement over the one that came before. So we have the interval bringing the person back with a personality, with an integration of their own. Each of individual is the sum of his own mistakes and also the sum of his own accomplishments. He comes back midstream in a great cycle of unfoldment. He comes forward with various degrees of achievement. And very often, the more advanced his degrees of achievement, the more simple his life will be here. Wise people do not wish to burden themselves with those excesses which contribute to temptation and misery. Therefore, those who have a deep understanding will probably live a simple life. But they will also have certain experiences which they will confront again. If necessary, they will be placed in a difficult family situation which they must solve because they didn't solve it before. Another one may find heavy emphasis upon honesty because he has not corrected his dishonesty in a previous life. Appetites also have very strong karmic consequences. And moral delinquencies are punished seriously. The individual must gradually realize that these punishments are in himself, that he wanted them, he needed them, he had to have them. But the moment he is embodied, he doesn't want them. So it is only between incarnations that he really gets a good look at himself. That is the time when the facts of life are most evident and normally available to him. And all these facts that apply to him are within the pattern of his own existence. He is not responsible to the patterns of other people. He is not responsible for anything except his own relationship with truth, and relationship which he is gradually building. As he goes further and further in this structural development, he will find out finally what his purpose is. And he will probably discover what the Egyptians decided it was, namely, that in due time this person will be in fact the very thing which is now his miniature existence. He will become a sun. He will become a great center of light. He will be a center of light in his family sometime. He will be a center of light in his country. He will be a center of light in the world and become one of the great teachers of mankind. And then he will go on beyond this. He will go on into the consciousness of planets and suns and space. He will be growing forever until in each of us the entire universal purpose is fulfilled. Therefore, the daily journey and the time it takes is a very inconsiderable thing. We will find as we go along that the journey that we are really making goes on for hundreds of lives. It goes on, but never twice the same. We never pay for something we didn't do. We never fail to get the reward of what we have done well. But these rewards are in terms of soul growth, not in terms of material circumstances. And as the individual goes further and further into the mystery of the soul world, or the world of soul, he will find that his citizenship there is far more important than his success or failures in this life. But we are all getting a little better. We are all growing. Sometimes a bad mistake is one of the most powerful forces for growth, because it suddenly brings us face to face with ourselves. We find that things like alcoholism, narcotics, addictions, and things of this nature become a great burden upon the soul. But the soul learns to overcome them, and in the overcoming it gains a strength otherwise impossible to it. So everywhere, every time, always, growth is going on to the best of the ability of the human being to perform growth. So in this way, the sun becomes a kind of master plan, which by coming around each time begins to bring a cycle of experiences to nature. Each year the sun comes back to the world. Each year the world is just a little different. Each year the sun performs a slightly different service. And over the period of ages, these services vary greatly. But in all cases, nature continues to produce this solar cycle. The sun, in order that it may fulfill its own purpose, The sun is the cleanser, the purifier, the illuminator. And it will come every time to carry on this particular task. Sometimes it will find a dark world waiting for it, heavily burdened with its own errors. Sometimes it will come to a better world, where things seem right. But always the sun in its cycle is working towards the one great end. And that great end, of course, is the final illumination of all that exists. That all things in themselves and by themselves and for themselves shall be fulfilled or be perfect in their needs and in their operations. Thus we can find in the old sacred books how often the sun deities are called by names that are more or less solar. How we find in every mythology the legend of the dying god. We find forever the mystery of the resurrection through dedication. And we also learn that in this world, gradually, happiness and security come from inward disciplines and dedications. That the individual who disciplines life to the best of his ability is gaining ground. The individual who is gradually weeding out his own selfishness, is gradually correcting his own intensities, who is gaining control of his emotions, and who is no longer able to injure others merely to the satisfaction of his own temperament. As these factors fade out, and the life is smoothed out as a quiet, gentle, growing towards reality. If it does this, and we are able to make it work in this way, we will find that every lifetime has importance. Now, those who are already partway through one of these lives, as we all are, has much to be grateful for. Many people between the middle life and the terminal years do go through a certain period of mental reorganization. Carl Jung, the psychiatrist, makes special notice of this. How people gradually, as they get older, become more and more aware of the universal and less bound to the local situations of living. Little by little, we get rid of the things that we don't need. We pass on to others what they want and we no longer want. And it becomes more and more obvious that for the long journey, it is best to travel light. And therefore, we dispose of ballast. We do not want it, because gradually we find that the things we love the most are not going to be permanent. We're going not to have them anyway, so we find ways of getting rid of them. But while that is true, that inside of ourselves, which is permanent growth, becomes more obvious every day. Permanent growth makes us happier, richer, and better equipped for the great cycles of life that lie before us. And actually, every time we come into the world, the sun moves northward and brings to us opportunities for growth. But most of all, the light, which is the internal and invisible sun, is bringing to ripeness and to fulfillment the harvest of precious powers and values locked within ourselves. As the sun produces the symbol of the sprouting of the seed, so the light within ourselves produces the ripening of all the inner values of consciousness. And the sun which brings the harvest to the earth, it brings as a light to the mind and hearts of human beings so that they may too have the harvest of their years and have a great and wonderful future. It all works out, and I think the vision of it as it was sensed and held and believed by the ancients is kind of worthwhile to give a little thought to at this season of the year. Thank you very much.